The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I promise the American people that all the information that is needed in order to create the indictment, to get a prosecution and a conviction, is in the hands of the district attorney.
Former Trump fixer Michael Cohen testified for 2 days before the Manhattan grand jury that's deciding whether to bring criminal charges against Donald Trump. If indictments are ultimately delivered in a case against Trump over a hush money payment to porn actress Stormy Daniels, Cohen will get the role he's been auditioning for since 2018, star witness for the prosecution against his old boss, a witness with a lot of baggage, including a felony conviction.
I'm not worried about it. The facts are the facts. The truth is the truth. And it's the truth will always rise. And so I'm not worried about anything that they want to come at me with.
But Trump's legal team sent attorney Bob Costello, a former legal advisor to Cohen, into the grand jury to testify that Cohen was not telling the truth.
The heart of it is that Michael Cohen told us that he was approached by Stormy Daniels' lawyer, and Stormy Daniels had negative information that she wanted to put in a lawsuit against Trump. So Michael Cohen decided on his own, that's what he told us, on his own, to see if he could take care of this.
Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Greg Farrell, who's been covering the case, and Michael Cohen. Has Michael Cohen been consistent? Has he been saying the same thing for years, or is there anything new in what he's saying?
He has been saying the same thing for years. He's written 2 books, and a lot of this was in his first book. He has stayed on message. To me, a big moment for Cohen was his appearance before the House committee in February of 2019, at which time he had pled guilty and flipped, if you will, or decided he was going to, you know, tell everything new about Trump world, about Trump, et cetera. And he understood that by going before that committee, he was going to get a barrage, a real, like the Republicans would hit him with everything they've got. So I remember watching that hearing beforehand, seeing like, okay, how is this guy going to handle it? Like the entire Republican world is going to come after him and insult him and just try to like really, 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 you know, crush him. And he handled himself quite well. He was credible. And the thing was about his credibility was that he was credible on the issues he was involved with. He was credible on issues that benefited Trump. He was asked about a meeting in Czechoslovakia and Russian collusion. He said, no, you know, the right answer for Democrats would have been, yes, him confirming everything that was in the Steele report and that sort of thing. But he said, no, and I was never in Prague and, you know, this and that. And the matter of factness with it, the accuracy of it. What also captured my attention was the last comment he made after putting up with the barrage of insults and insinuations about his wife and all that sort of thing was at the end of the day, Elijah Cummings asked him, you know, for a final thought. And he said that his greatest concern was that, and this was in 2018, February, I think, of 2018. He said his greatest concern is that from what he knew about Trump, and he knew him well, if Trump lost the 2020 election, there would not be a peaceful transfer of power. And I remember on January 6th calling him up from this office saying, you were right, you know, and people had not listened to him or taken that. But in fact, it was true. So Cohen, yes, you can call him a liar and a perjurer, because he did. He lied to Congress. And he's probably told a lot of lies in the service of Donald Trump and in his own service throughout much of his career. But, you know, since then, since that time, and I've talked to him a lot over the years since this happened and since, you know, January of 2020, he has been remarkably consistent. You know, he's got a very healthy ego. He's got a chip on his shoulder, not just towards Trump, but because how he felt he was treated by SDNY. But he's a consistent character.
So is it true that, from what we know of the Manhattan DA's case, that it could not go forward without Michael Cohen as a witness?
It seems pretty obvious at this point, yes, he has to be involved. Otherwise, because we know from previous reporting and Mark Pomerantz's book that one of Bragg's concerns 12, 13 months ago about the case that he inherited from Cy Vance was its heavy dependence on Michael Cohen. And Bragg, newly elected and under fire for, you know, his bail reform programs, it said the last thing he wanted to do was just stake his reputation. And Bragg's whole first term is going to come down to this issue in front of him. And he knew that Michael Cohen's credibility, and he was just not, you know, he wasn't there. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, Mark Pomerantz, a former prosecutor with the Manhattan DA's office who quit last year, said in his book that Bragg told subordinates he could not see a world in which he would rely on Cohen as the foundational witness in a case against Trump. So what do you think happened to change that?
Well, you should read other parts of Pomerantz's book. Pomerantz's book, in some ways, is helpful in terms of he's an outsider, even though he worked, you know, on loan to the DA's office for the Trump investigation. But he talks in his book about how he needed to get comfortable with Cohen and how he would bring Cohen in over and over. And over the course of time, the consistency of the story, et cetera, convinced him that, you know, Michael Cohen would not wilt on the stand, would be good. And with a caveat that, and we reported this in our Cohen story this week, you know, it's certain that prosecutors will corroborate everything. Michael Cohen says that no one's going to take his word. He understands that, you know, just his word versus Donald Trump's word. But the corroboration that can be brought with him as a guide walking the jury through whatever it is that the DA wants to prove. So Pomerantz had this own journey. I'm sure Pomerantz first thing didn't think, oh, Michael Cohen, what a great witness. He needed to be brought along. And Pomerantz spent a lot of time with him and got to that point. And I think it's clear from Cohen being invited in to speak to the DA's office in, I think, mid-January, and then coming back several more times, Bragg's own team also wanted to get to that comfort level. And it appears as though they have. So, yes, then we have this wrinkle with Bob Costello. But still, we have, like, Bragg's people certainly got to the point where they brought him to the grand jury, not just in to speak with them, but, you know, on the record before the grand jury.
So while we're here, let's talk about the problem with Robert Costello, who – can we call him a former legal advisor to Michael Cohen? I don't even know.
I guess you can
call
him a legal advisor. That's the safest thing, because Cohen says, yes, he advised me, but he denies that he was, like, actually serving as his lawyer.
So he's called to the grand jury, apparently at the request of Trump's lawyers. And he said afterwards, I told the grand jury that this guy couldn't tell the truth if you put a gun to his head.
That seems a bit extreme, because Cohen has like a history of telling truth. But he's also a voluble New York character, so he's easy to caricature as a liar. He has a long history that Cohen, you know, went through in his book Mea Culpa about how he used to abuse and mistreat Trump's enemies all the way up to, you know, that 2017, 2018.
What was Costello's point there at the grand jury?
Well, if his grand point, he's calling Michael Cohen a liar in the big picture. But I think the only evidence Costello himself has is what he told, what he was aware of in Michael Cohen and what he told to prosecutors at SDNY. Because Costello's story, and he's been consistent with this for a few years, is that, you know, yes, he did advise Michael Cohen. Actually, I think Costello thinks he was his lawyer for record. And at a certain point, Michael Cohen apparently, in an attempt to, you know, curry favor or whatever, waived his attorney-client privilege, which, of course, gave Costello the opportunity to go in and tell SDNY prosecutors what he really thought. At that point, Cohen had left the fold. If you recall, Cohen reported that early on in his first phone call, Costello had told him, don't worry, you've got friends in high places, you're going to be okay, or words to that effect. Right. And so I've dealt with Costello. I consider him a very, you know, legitimate, straightforward, honest guy. But now we're getting into perceptions, and maybe what Costello said to Cohen could be interpreted by Cohen as friends in high places. That means I'm going to get a pardon or something like that. And maybe Costello didn't mean it that way, just that, you know, don't worry, stay on the team, whatever. So I think, you know, we're in the weeds of a dispute between two strong-willed lawyers.
And the grand jury was expected to meet today, but it was called off.
So obviously we've got everybody reading tea leaves. What does this mean? You know, has this changed strategy? Is it because of Costello? It could be because, you know, somebody had a dentist appointment. We don't know. You know, maybe it'll come out. Yeah, there's something, you know, some drama there. But I doubt it. It's probably some mundane reason. Ever since Trump on Saturday morning posted his thing on Truth Social about how he expected to be arrested on Tuesday, it's gotten all of us in the media sort of on tenterhooks, like, oh, it's about to happen. It's about to happen. If there's one thing we learned about Alvin Bragg a year ago is that he's not necessarily going to rush something. Having said that, he's moved quickly in the last 2 months to build whatever case he's planning to bring. We know it's near the end because prosecutors did invite Trump to come in and make a presentation before the grand jury. That's a sort of chess game that most lawyers in New York, you know, white-collar criminal investigations targets play. Trump's lawyers indicate 2 months ago something to the effect to Bragg's office, we understand you're looking at our client. Before you make any charging decisions, we reserve the right to make our presentation before the grand jury. So once that's in, Bragg's office has to afford Trump the opportunity to speak to the grand jury. Fast forward, like I guess 2 weeks ago when this came out, that Trump had in fact received that invite. And of course, his lawyers have said no, they don't want Trump to appear before the grand jury. But that signaled to Trump's team that, okay, the end is nigh. You know, we're near the goal line on whatever decision Bragg's going to make. And then after that, Cohen, for the first time, having spoken to the DA's office and to prosecutors several times, Cohen last week finally went before the grand jury. A lot of us interpreted that as they were holding Cohen back from the grand jury in case Trump did show up and make the case of why this is like he had no idea about Stormy Daniels. And Trump's a good salesman. And if he were on his game before the grand jury, I bet you he could do an excellent convincing job telling them this is much ado about nothing. So I think, and this is just my presumption, we don't know this, but it fits the pattern that Michael Cohen was held out of the grand jury proceedings until it was clear Trump wasn't going to testify. Because if he did, then they would bring Cohen in to refute the points that Trump would have made had he showed up before the grand jury.
So late last year, Alvin Bragg's office won a conviction of Trump's family real estate company on tax fraud charges. Trump was not a defendant in that case. That seems like it would have been a much easier case to make. Any inkling as to why he wasn't a defendant in that case? His CFO was.
Yes, and good question. The reason he was not, and the case was, just to review for your listeners, the DA's office brought a case against two units of the Trump Organization, Trump Payroll Corp and the Trump Corporation. The Trump Corporation is sort of the corporate entity with all the brass works. And Alan Weisberg was the CFO, and Jeff McConney was the controller, and a bunch of other people beneath Trump. This grew out of the original charge from June, July 2021, when under Bragg's predecessor, Cy Vance, these two Trump organizations and Weisselberg himself were criminally charged with, you know, tax abuse and one case of grand larceny in the second degree against Weisselberg for getting a refund from the IRS when he didn't deserve one because of all the perks and benefits he received. Anyway, I think the original goal of Vance's office was to use that, get Weisselberg to flip, and then build the bigger case against Trump. The problem was Weisselberg decided not to do that. Eventually, Weisselberg did agree to plead guilty when all of his attempts to get the case thrown out were rejected by, you know, an appeals court. When that failed, he finally cried uncle last August and pled guilty to his crimes. But he's very clear he pled guilty to his crimes and only his crimes. He would be willing to testify about what he did to violate the law at any trial that were coming. But it was clear that he was not going to talk about Trump or implicate Trump in any way. So that's the backdrop to the trial. And the trial is a trial of two corporate entities. And there's no human being on trial. But Weisselberg was the star witness. And it was pretty convincing. Trump's lawyers, and I think this is just part of being in Trump world, were adamant from the start. And the prosecution was too. They told the jurors right up front, this is not about, you know, Donald Trump. You know, and that's the elephant in the room here. It's about these two units of his company and some subordinates did the following. And that's what the case is going to be about. Trump's lawyers went to great pains to make sure that the jury understood and the general public did that Trump himself nor his children were involved in anything like this. They said it over and over, even though he wasn't on trial. They made that a point over and over, I think for public, you know, perception's sake, not for legal points. But they did it so much that by the end, I think the prosecution was feeling confident. They said, no, we think Trump was aware of it. He's not charged, but, you know, it's clear his signatures are on the checks. He signed every check over $2,500 and a lot of ones that were smaller until he was president. So they put Trump into this, and obviously he wasn't charged, but, you know, the jury clearly understood that this stuff had the blessing of Donald Trump, but he was not on trial. So maybe the jury would have had a different result. It would have been a tougher conviction. It turned out to be an easy conviction. It would have been a tougher conviction if Trump himself had been part of that trial.
So Alvin Bragg, he's already facing so much criticism from Republicans.
And an investigation, right, from three prominent Republicans who head up important committees basically fired a shot across his bow, warning him that they're going to, like, drag him in for hearings, and they want all communications between, you know, the two former prosecutors who left and Trump, and, you know, blah, 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 and anything that mentions Trump. So they really are going to go to war in support of Trump and to try to degrade, you know, Bragg's ability to prosecute this case.
I assume there's going to be a fight about whether he has to comply with any of that.
I don't know. I think he's planning to go ahead and do the case that he's planning to do. I don't think he's going to be intimidated by it. And I'm not sure that Congress will be able to interfere. I think it makes for good press and it plays well to the constituents. There's an interesting federal question here. Yes, there is congressional oversight of matters concerning, like, law and order in the U.S. But at a certain point, I'm not sure that they can actually impede or blow up, you know, a local DA's prosecution. The Supreme Court passed on this. They allowed Vance's office to get the tax returns and conduct an investigation into a sitting president. So, although by that time Trump is gone.
Do you think that Alvin Bragg, so he's going to be at the center of all this criticism, the legal political storm that follows, do you think he has the experience and personality to be able to withstand everything that's going to come his way?
I think so. I think, first of all, if you go back to when he started and, you know, everything coming down on him in the first month when he had that, you know, clearly poorly thought out and poorly executed day one memo, which essentially was a message that, you know, don't prosecute, you know, people for certain types of robberies, assaults or gun possession or resisting arrest, et cetera, that blew up in his face. And then the murder of two New York City policemen in the month of January of last year, that was not directly attributable, but it sort of went with this theme of, like, this guy's not going to prosecute low-level crooks and this is what's happening to our police. We've got to protect them. So he had a terrible month there. And then he's got these two guys, the holdovers from the Vance investigation, highly respected prosecutors. In the case of Mark Pomerantz, a highly respected prosecutor in the 1990s who went on to have a very successful career as a corporate defense lawyer for Paul Weiss. And then Kerry Dunn, who was Cy Vance's general counsel and served as the lead of the prosecution team, but he was not really a career prosecutor either. But they were in charge of the Trump investigation. And there was a bit of, like, sleight of hand is too strong a word, but if this case was ready to go, all this drama over Mark Pomerantz and him refusing to get his way with Bragg, Cy Vance should have brought the case. Instead, Bragg gets this thing that's going to be totally on him now. He owns it, but the two guys that are leading it are insisting they've got to go to the grand jury and get the indictment done by essentially the end of March of last year. It's our last chance to get Donald Trump. And the further he gets into it, Bragg just thinks, like, you know, guys, we're not there. This needs more work. And Pomerantz, I won't, you know, to describe what he did because he wrote a whole book about it, but he essentially picked up his marbles and left and wrote a very damaging inflammatory memo criticizing Bragg, which was coincidentally leaked to the New York Times. So that was another really bad moment for Bragg, but he didn't melt under the pressure of what happened in January. He didn't melt under that pressure. I'm not sure. He kept saying that the investigation's ongoing. I guess we have to take him at his word. There were no obvious signs that the investigation was continuing. But I think the trial of the two Trump Organization units and the resounding victory he got certainly helped, you know, build confidence in his own team, not a team that consisted of, you know, Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, who I think were going to leave after the indictment. They would be able to go out in a blaze of glory saying they got an indictment of Trump and then leave. If it's a weak case, leave it for Alvin Bragg. That's a bad thing, as you know, as a lawyer. Yeah. When a prosecutor feels strong about a case, brings a case, and then leaves and somebody else has to pick it up, it's like, you know, you Seriously. Want to stay there through yeah. it. You know what I mean? So anyway, Bragg handled that very well. This is going to be to a much higher degree. But he's a very youthful-looking guy, but he has a number of years of experience. He had more prosecutorial experience than Cy Vance had, certainly than Kerry Dunn had, both at the state level and at the federal level.
And he may end up having experience holding a press conference about the first criminal charges against a former president. Thanks so much, Greg. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Greg Farrell. Up next, federal judges are leaving the bench for lucrative law jobs.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Resigning from a coveted lifetime appointment as a federal judge is seen as a rare step. But since August, four Obama appointees have left the bench for lucrative jobs at law firms. Joining me is Carl Tobias, a professor at the University of Richmond Law School. When did the shift toward appointing younger judges start? In what administration?
Well, I mean, I think it's grown in the modern era, as early as Carter, but I think was accelerated after 2000. You see more in the, say, Bush administration, and then coming forward, and especially accelerated during the administration of President Trump. You can look at the figures, especially on the appeals courts. I think much younger judges were appointed by him than, say, Clinton or even Obama. And I think Biden has continued that to a considerable extent, especially on the appeals courts.
So Maryland District Court Judge George Hazel and Texas Appellate Judge Greg Costa, they're 47 and 50 respectively. They're among five Obama appointees who since August have resigned or announced their intention to leave the bench. Is the motivating factor making more money?
I think that's part of it, and I think Judge Hazel spoke to that in a piece one of your writers did for Bloomberg. But there are many factors, and I think Judge Costa has been quoted as saying the judiciary has become much more politicized since he was appointed to the district bench in the early Obama years. And you have, I think, Paul Watford on the Ninth Circuit perhaps looking at some of the same considerations, but especially people who live in urban areas where it may be very expensive to live and have children who are going to college, it can be tough. Even though the salary looks very good to many people, it's not that high in terms of comparison with where the judges are going to these major law firms.
Yeah, so federal district judges make just under $233,000 this year. Appeals court judges will make more than $246,000. Hazel is going to Gibson Dunn, which reported more than $4.4 million in profits per equity partner last year. So no comparison.
Well, that's right. You live in New York and you know, but I mean, Hazel is in the D.C. metropolitan area. And housing and college costs are expensive. And so you do have that phenomenon. It's worrisome. I don't think Congress is inclined to raise the pay very quickly for federal judges. It's always been very close to what members of Congress are paid. So you have that issue. And some questions about whether serving on the federal bench is a capstone to a person's career or something else. And different judges view it differently and have different circumstances. And it may be a dilemma that presidents need to think about when appointing people.
Law firms like to have former judges on their roster, I assume.
Yes, and Judge Hazel spoke to that. I think that's absolutely the case. Judge Feinerman, also Northern District of Illinois, went with another big firm because they know their way around a courtroom. They know all the federal judges in the courthouse, probably downtown. And so they can be very effective, and clients like to have federal judges handling their cases. All that works together, but it may deprive the bench of some very fine judges.
Is the workload in private practice heavier than the workload on the bench?
I think it depends on the district and the firm and how the profits are distributed and those kind of considerations. But yes, it can be, but federal judges are used to working with a fleet of clerks who are quite similar to the types of younger lawyers they might be working with in the firm. So I think they know how to work with a team in chambers and the same in a firm.
We've talked about this before, and it's noticeable with the Supreme Court that a Supreme Court justice will wait until there's a president in office that matches the political affiliation of the president who appointed him. So Republican appointees wait for Republican presidents, Democratic appointees wait for Democratic presidents. Is it similar with judges on the appellate and district court levels?
I think less so. Even at the Supreme Court, it's a custom of tradition that isn't always followed. But as you move down the hierarchy, I think you see less attention paid to that, especially at the district court level, but even the appellate level. Although we did see that it seemed a number of appointees of Democratic presidents were waiting to see if Trump would be reelected in 2020 and then assume senior status. But it's surprising how few Republican appointees have assumed senior status in the first 2 years of the Biden presidency. And so we may be seeing that, which is unfortunate. You would like to depoliticize, if you could, that process. But there are all kinds of reasons why judges decide to assume senior status or when they decide to do that.
So then is it time to reconsider appointing judges who are in their 40s?
Well, it may be. All presidents may want to think about that, but people make all kinds of choices, and it shouldn't be that the federal judges have to worry about that too much. I don't know what the answer to that is. It doesn't have an easy solution. But, of course, the president wants to have younger people because, of course, they then serve longer periods if they stay on the bench.
And judges also retire and then go to big law firms afterwards.
That's right. Some do and are quite successful. And we know of many who do that. And a number do stay on as senior judges for years afterwards. And it's really a valuable kind of situation because you get a new, younger, fresh blood type of appointee. And you get to capitalize on the experience of the federal judges to assume senior status, who often will have a lighter load, sometimes a half load. That's very valuable to the federal bench to have those senior judges, and they've bailed out the Ninth Circuit and a number of other appeals courts and district courts where they're substantial dockets. They just wouldn't be afloat if they didn't have those valuable senior judges.
Speaking of needing judges, let's talk about some of the new nominees. The president announced four nominees for district courts on Monday, including a selection for a state with two Republican senators. So tell us about Louisiana.
Yes. One big problem that you're alluding to is in the red states, there are many vacancies that are unfilled, and there are questions about whether the Republican senators in those states are cooperating. And the classic examples are in Florida and Texas, where I think both have four emergency vacancies right now, and a number of other red states where their two Republican senators have no nominees more than 2 years into the administration. But there have been inroads, and for example, the Indiana senators have been very helpful in working with the White House at the instigation, I think, of both Senator Graham, the ranking member on the committee, and Dick Durbin, the chair of the committee, who's from Illinois in the Seventh Circuit, and they work very well together on picking a new nominee named Brookman, a magistrate judge there, and everybody seems very happy with that person. So in Louisiana, there is someone named Papillon, who's a plaintiff-side personal injury tort product liability lawyer who enjoys a very fine reputation there and certainly is experienced in federal court litigation. And he's been nominated, and one of the senators, at least, was on board. I don't know about Senator Kennedy, but Senator Cassidy, some very positive comments to make. So that's a promising sign. And earlier, both in Indiana and in Louisiana, these senators were supportive of two appellate nominees, now Judge Pryor in Indiana and Judge Douglas in Louisiana. So it's possible that we'll see less vacancies in the red states. And that's the hope of the White House and of Senators Graham and Durbin.
So then I take it you don't agree that some progressives are pushing for Democrats to eliminate the blue slip practice.
Well, it may not be necessary if the White House can continue to work with the home state senators in red states. And Lindsey Graham makes a good point that you're talking about someone who's going to enjoy life tenure in the state that a senator represents, and you want the senators to have some say-so over that because they'll be blamed if the nominee turns out to be incompetent or isn't working as effectively as the judge might. So there is a need to have some responsibility for that choice. And I'm cautiously optimistic that Republicans, as we've seen in Louisiana and Indiana and other states, Idaho is another, working with the White House. But the White House also, as Durbin says, and I think the White House counsel knows, has to cooperate with the home state senators. And so I think they're all moving in the same direction, with some exceptions.
Let's turn now to more seats, more judiciary seats. The federal judiciary is again asking for more new judgeships from Congress, and it sliced its previous request from 2021 by several positions. Why has Congress, despite yearly repeated requests, why has Congress not addressed this?
In a word, partisanship. The party that does not occupy the White House is extremely reluctant to agree to new judgeships that would be appointed. For example, Republicans, certainly Democrats would not have wanted President Trump to have any more nominees and appointees than he had. And a similar dynamic is now taking hold with Republicans looking at judgeships bills. So we haven't had a comprehensive judgeship act since 1990. And, of course, the country and the dockets have grown since that point in time, not to mention the backlog created by COVID-19. And so in certain districts, there are really pressing needs. And so it seems to me maybe not a comprehensive, nationwide bill, but maybe a targeted one would be feasible. For example, look at California or the border states. Look at Arizona, Texas. The judges are drowning in those dockets. And they need more resources. And so it might be better to do it state by state, and that might be more palatable, I think. So maybe that's the better approach, even though it's very hard on the judges. And there you come back to the senior judges who have kept, the California districts, for example, all of which vacancies are emergencies. There were 17 when Trump started. There were 17 when he finished. There were 17 when Obama started, but they have whittled that down to fewer than 10. And so that's progress.
Thanks, Carl. That's Professor Carl Tobias of the University of Richmond Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.